From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On his first full day in office, President Biden is signing more directives, including one calling on agencies to use the Defense Production Act to boost supplies of medical equipment, COVID-19 tests, and vaccines. A year ago yesterday, the first case of COVID-19 in the U.S. was diagnosed in Washington State. Since then, more than 400,000 people here have died from it. We're going to start this hour with Dr. Michael Osterholm, infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota, also part of Biden's coronavirus advisory board, and someone who would have the right to say, I told you so. Doctor, didn't you write a paper a year ago this week based on what you were watching in Wuhan, China, and predicting a pandemic?
Well, I did. I put out a document on January 20th, 2020, saying that this would cause the next pandemic and that we had to be doing everything we could to prepare for it.
Yeah. Well, sadly, people said it would disappear. It did not. Bring us up to date. A week ago, it was discovered there was no stockpile of vaccines as thought. Now it's being reported that President Biden's team says there's no vaccine distribution plan from the Trump administration. Is that true? And if so, can President Biden carry out his promise of 100 million vaccinations in the first 100 days?
Well, first of all, it is true. There is no plan or was no plan by the Trump administration in terms of distribution, how to actually talk to the public about these vaccines and educate them about why they're so important to their health. The issue, however, is what can we do going forward? And yesterday, the White House issued a national strategy for COVID-19 response and pandemic preparedness, which has seven major goals, which is the plan that we've all been looking for the last year. While it doesn't go into the drill down into the detail that we can talk about in terms of how we're going to achieve those 100 million doses of vaccine in the next 100 days, I do think as much as it's aspirational, it's very doable. And I commend the administration for taking on this this goal.
Yeah. And where are we? Case counts are declining in nearly every state. But we also heard Dr. Sanjay Gupta on CNN repeat this morning that the next few weeks would be very dark and critical. So have we peaked? Have we yet to peak? And what about the new variant? You know, that it makes it more contagious. Where are we?
I think we're simply in the most dangerous part of the pandemic. I think the next 6 to 14 weeks could be the darkest days. What we've done is we've watched our case numbers basically continue to hit a peak and then come down, hit a peak and then come down. And each time the peaks get higher and each time the coming down doesn't get nearly as low. And right now we're at about 185,000 cases reported per day. You know, we were earlier in the month up to 300,000 cases. But if this new variant, the B117 variant from the UK, takes off as we think it surely could, we could be looking back at a day in the near future where 300,000 cases a day doesn't seem all that bad. That's a very chilling thought, but I think that's exactly where we're at.
So it sounds like one of the most important things President Biden is doing is his mandate that everyone wear masks on federal land, just sending out the signal. I mean, we saw so many masks. You couldn't even tell who people were at the inauguration. Masks, it sounds like it's still the byword.
It is. I mean, the point being is the vaccines are critical, but they are surely not going to save us from this next round of increased cases should this new variant take off. You know, if we vaccinate the 100 million doses into people in this country, that still only protect about 14% of us. You should wear a mask. At the same time, distancing is going to be the ultimate and most important activity we can do. And we've hit a country right now that has severe pandemic fatigue, pandemic anger. Unfortunately, that all contributes to why these could be the darkest days of the pandemic going ahead, with a much more infectious virus and a population that is, unfortunately, in far too many areas, done with doing what they would need to do for this pandemic.
Right. Just briefly, Dr. Osterholm, yesterday President Biden called for a moment of prayer for the over 400,000 Americans dead. I think that's the first time we've had that kind of a solemn recognition. I just wondered your thoughts at that moment.
Well, for those of us who have been working in this area, I don't think there was one of us that had a dry eye at that moment. It was solemn. It was right. And most of all, it gave us the understanding of just what this pandemic has done. You know, we've tried to address this pandemic over the course of recent months with vaccine, and it sure makes sense, but we have not explored our soul. So yesterday was a recognition of that, and it was spoke much more loudly than just a virus. It spoke to the very heart and soul of who we are as a country.
Dr. Michael Osterholm of the University of Minnesota and President Biden's Coronavirus Advisory Board, thank you.
Thank you.
President Biden is inheriting, as we know, a politically and racially divided country. How does one begin to heal from that divide? One of the ways other war-torn countries have done it is through something called transitional justice. Anna Miriam Rocatello joins us for more on this. She's the Deputy Executive Director of the International Center of Transitional Justice and a former UN official. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You've used transitional justice techniques to help build back up countries after wars. It's a technique you say should definitely be applied here in the United States. What exactly is transitional justice?
So transitional justice is generally defined as that set of measures, or as I prefer to say, political processes that are applied to provide justice in contexts that have witnessed a massive number of violations of the most fundamental rights, to an extent that the social contract between citizens and institutions has deteriorated or collapsed at times. And therefore, it is imperative to renegotiate that social contract based on equality and recognition and protection of the rights of everyone.
Okay, so you said a couple of things here that really stood out to me. You said it's after a recognition of wrongdoing that has happened. We still have half of this country that does not believe that what we experienced during the last administration might have been problematic, but there are some similarities there that you found. So here in the United States, you said that transitional justice should be used to address systemic abuses and harms linked to the legacy of slavery. How would this work?
It's really up to the society where it is applied to determine what processes works better to reach, as you mentioned at the beginning, for example, a narrative, a historic narrative that is shareable, to provide the most ample acknowledgement of wrongdoings, to offer restoration of rights and prevention that those wrongdoings, abuses, and violations will not occur again.
Okay, I think hearing you speak, a lot of us are wondering, what are some real life examples? Some of this work, especially around repair and reparation, is already happening across the United States.
First of all, I would like to mention also the various initiatives of truth seeking and truth telling that have taken place over the years in the United States, like Ferguson or Greensboro, and that now, after the summer, have now been considered and being implemented by cities at the local level. The Massachusetts, for example, Lynching Truth Commission is one that we are closely looking at and trying to assist. So truth is certainly the cornerstone of any political transition, to have a base that can inspire reforms and corrective measures.
I hear from you over and over again the word truth, truth. As President Biden laid out in his inauguration speech yesterday, Americans don't have a shared truth, though, on history and what's happening in this moment. Do you see this as the biggest challenge impeding this work of healing? And really, what do you think needs to happen first to begin this work?
So the issue here, at least in my personal opinion in the United States, is not that the truth is not there. The truth, it was well documented in a context of, that is highly institutionalized, that has produced the most eminent historian, activist, and political analysts. So the truth is out there. The issue is how to share, how to speak about that truth, and how to reach those that, for a different ideological position, do not see that truth or do not realize how a legacy of racial injustice has permeated the contemporary history and has slavery has transformed into other forms of discrimination and marginalization. That is the challenge, and is a challenge that is everywhere, in every context, where we undertake the big challenge of changing. This is a long, these are long processes that require multiple policy choices to make the change effective.
That's Anna Mariam Rocatello, Deputy Executive Director of the International Center of Transitional Justice. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
There is an untold number of COVID-19 survivors across the world who struggle with long-term symptoms and complications from the virus. As Connecticut Public Radio's Nicole Leonard reports, that's led to the creation of dedicated programs for long-term treatment, and they're expanding as the need continues to grow.
Vic Guerra was admitted to a hospital in Hartford, Connecticut in late March with what are now known as COVID-19 symptoms. He was quarantined immediately, separated from his wife.
I saw her maybe 15, 20 feet away, and I just barely raised my hand and said goodbye to her. And it's here for a month.
The 57-year-old manufacturing executive was intubated and spent 11 days on a ventilator, which helped him breathe. Like so many others who required intensive care, Guerra was transferred to a rehabilitation hospital for a short time before he was sent home. He thought the worst was behind him, but by midsummer, he wasn't getting better.
The exhaustion was just so severe, and headaches were back. My balance got worse, and then the brain fog set in.
Guerra then found an online support group for COVID-19 survivors run by Gaylord Hospital in nearby Wallingford.
Not until I was contacted did I learn that, oh my God, there's other people like me that are suffering almost identical situations.
Scientists don't yet know how common long-term complications and symptoms occur in survivors, but what they do know is that these problems can be both physical and mental in nature, and they can prevent people from making a full recovery. That's why Dr. Jerry Kaplan says his hospital joined other health organizations across the country in creating an outpatient COVID-19 recovery program.
We're now seeing patients that have had some of those symptoms for 8-9 months.
Kaplan says the symptoms and complications run the gamut, from respiratory problems, heart issues, neurological deficits, and more. The outpatient programs offers occupational and physical therapies, as well as nutrition guidance and psychological treatment.
Certainly, as we see more patients who are hospitalized with COVID now, we will continue to see the need for COVID recovery programs in the future.
The post-COVID-19 recovery program at Yale Medicine in New Haven started as a one-day-a-week clinic. It's now open 3 days.
We're getting more referrals as people are further and further from their acute infection with persistent symptoms.
That's Dr. Denise Lutchman-Singh, a pulmonary and critical care physician who leads the Yale recovery program. She and her colleagues expected that the patients who had moderate to severe COVID-19 illnesses would be the ones needing recovery services the most. But that's only been partly true.
Because patients who were classified as mild disease have also had persistent symptoms, almost as severe as a patient who was hospitalized in an intensive care unit.
The clinic is also treating a wide age range. Lutchman-Singh says the long-term symptoms can be especially challenging for her youngest patients.
They expected to recover very quickly and move on. If they were in their 30s or 40s, physically fit before, I've had patients who were runners before and athletic in inclination, who now struggle to walk up a flight of stairs.
Dr. Serena Spodich says she too is seeing a surprising number of younger patients at a neuro-COVID clinic at Yale Medicine. Many patients were never hospitalized, but are now experiencing numbness and tingling, headaches, loss or impaired senses of smell, taste, or hearing, as well as cognitive issues. Spodich says there needs to be more research into the links between severity of COVID-19 illness and long-term complications.
It's really important to try to understand why some people get these neurologic issues. And many people don't seem to, right? I mean, I know lots of people who've recovered from COVID who seem completely fine.
But what patients often want to know is, when will their health get back to what it was prior to COVID-19? And Spodich says health experts don't yet have a good answer to that.
So although I can't say when are these general symptoms going to end, I think it is very helpful for patients to realize that some of the symptoms you're having, we really do have good treatments for.
As for COVID-19 survivor Vic Guerra, he tries to take his recovery one day at a time.
Wake up in the morning, sit on the edge of the bed, be thankful for this day, and don't be negative. And my parents always said, it's easy to find the negative in anybody or anything. Look for the positive.
Health experts urge COVID-19 survivors to seek professional help if they are still experiencing lingering health issues 6 weeks after their acute illness. For Here and Now, I'm Nicole Leonard.
Well, in some time now to remember Stat News science journalist Sharon Begley. Well, that doesn't even come close to describing her impact on the world of science journalism. Her cover stories for Newsweek sold out. Her column in the Wall Street Journal was a favorite of famous scientists. A non-smoker, Sharon passed away at 64 on Saturday from complications of lung cancer while she was trying to finish a column about lung cancer. Sharon was a regular on Here and Now, and we've invited her editor, Gideon Gill, for some remembrances, but also to get across what she was trying to get across in her last week of life. Gideon, what a loss for the world of science journalism, but also for you. We're so sorry.
Thank you, Robin.
How would you describe Sharon Begley?
Sharon was really a giant in science journalism, both for the clarity and sharpness of her writing, as well as her voice. She, you know, as an editor, you're in some ways a teacher, and but she taught me way more than I ever taught her. She taught me about questioning everything, staying curious, writing with such beauty. She had such ability to turn a phrase. I remember she once wrote about a particular kind of genetic molecule called a gene drive, and she wrote that they were as readily available as tea cozies on Etsy. But at the same time, she also could wield a surgeon's scalpel in her writing. And so back in 2017, one of my favorite things she wrote was about she wrote a number of stories about sickle cell disease and how neglected people with that disease are, both by researchers. It's improved a little bit in recent years since she wrote these stories, but also about the terrible care that many people with sickle cell get. And, you know, she just wrote a simple declarative sentence: the U.S. healthcare system is killing adults with sickle cell disease.
We will link people to those gutting stories of Black patients with sickle cell disease. It's referenced in the beautiful obituary that was written about her, in which we also learned that James Hansen, you know, the top climate scientist, said she was at the top of the science reporting class. She was science writing royalty. She wrote about everything from quarks to caveman crooners to plants, anti-aphid defenses. But just tell us, what did she want to communicate about the kind of lung cancer that she had, a non-smoker?
Yes. So several months ago, so she was first diagnosed in July. When she started feeling a little bit better, she said to me that she wants to write about, she wants to do some research and write about lung cancer in never smokers. And what she found, and this, we're actually going to be publishing her last story next week. And so I'll just, you know, among the things she found is that there's a lot of debate about whether lung cancer is actually, there's some indications it's increasing in people who were never smokers, particularly in women. Half of the lung cancer cases in women are among never smokers. And the type of cancer, the cancer is not the same. Its characteristics are different in people who have never smoked than the kind of lung cancer that people that once did smoke or current smokers have. And that creates, that means that different treatments might be in order. There hasn't really been much attention paid to this until recently, and I think that's part of why she wanted to write this story.
Well, we will pay attention when it comes out. And just from what we knew of her, that seems so appropriate. She was writing it up until her death.
Yes, her husband sent me an email last week just before she died to say that he wrote to me, quote, "I did not read it, but know she put a lot of work into it. And from my listening post across the room, she was still the same sharp reporter and writer as ever, though her energy and ability to concentrate were flagging. She struggled to finish it and was so happy when she filed it with you. Given the subject matter, I hope you share my sense that if this proves to be the last thing she ever published, how fitting that would be."
That's Gideon Gill, editor at STAT, the health and medicine publication, speaking about his colleague, one of our favorites, Sharon Begley, who died this past Saturday from complications from lung cancer, a non-smoker. And we will be reading her thoughts on that. Gideon, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Sharon Begley is survived by her husband, Ned Groth, her sister, Barbara Suzuki, her children, Daniel and Sarah.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
The newest strain of the coronavirus has made its way to Brazil, and it's being blamed for the surge in new cases there. Right now, Brazil has the second highest number of COVID-19 deaths in the world, second only to the United States. Well, this week, the country started getting a new vaccine from the Chinese company Sinovac into the arms of people. The first person to receive it was a nurse on Monday. The BBC's South America correspondent Katie Watson joins us from Sao Paulo with the latest. And Katie, how is this vaccine rollout going so far?
Well, it's very early days. Of course, Jair Bolsonaro, the president, has been heavily criticized for his approach and how he's handled this pandemic. Initially, he was quite scathing. He continues to make unfounded comments or sows unfounded doubts about the vaccines. And the vaccine that has been rolled out so far is the vaccine that's been developed from the Sinovac laboratory, the Chinese laboratory, in connection with Butantan Institute, which is one of the foremost scientific research institutes in Brazil. But it's been pushed heavily by the Sao Paulo governor, João Doria, who is a political rival of Jair Bolsonaro. So it's still very patchy coverage. I was up in Manaus, I'm in the Amazon just this week, and speaking to some smaller communities who say that they've had a handful of vaccines. They don't know when they're going to get any more. And I think that speaks to both the size and the scale of the rollout in Brazil. It's a very difficult country to be able to get full coverage, but at the same time also the fact that the political backing has not been united, certainly from the very beginning of this pandemic.
You mentioned Manaus, where you spent 2 days there in the city, and we hear that there's an oxygen shortage. It really sounds like a terrible situation there. Can you tell us more about what you saw?
I arrived a few days ago, and I saw people queuing for oxygen at private, gas companies. And it was a pilgrimage they did every day because people who need oxygen, who've got COVID-19, often get through a whole cylinder. And there was, people go every single day just to refill and to be able to come back. And when I asked them, why don't you take your family to hospital? The answer was, well, there's no space. And, I don't want them to die there. So it was a real struggle. And even in the private hospitals, I was in one private hospital where there were 250 beds reserved for COVID-19 this wave. It was 150 last year in the first wave. They worry that what we're seeing in Manaus is so much worse than the first wave. And the questions are, of course, is this down to the new variant? But certainly there's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned President Bolsonaro's response. I mean, we've been hearing a lot about his response here in the United States, that he's really downplayed the pandemic. He won't even wear a mask. I mean, what you're laying out for us here, is the country basically paying the price for him not taking it more seriously?
I think a lot of people would say that. I think the whole thing has become deeply, deeply political. People do to a certain extent, follow rules. But there's also the issue of locking down for months and months. This is a country where many millions of people have to work every single day to be able to put food on the table for their families. And that's true, but they also need to be protected. So that's been a big trade-off that we've seen. And I think the effects are being seen now in Brazil.
Sounds very familiar. Sounds so much like what we experienced here. Katie Watson is the BBC South America correspondent. Thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
How will a President Biden in the White House affect the news landscape? Former President Trump came from a combative reality television background. You're fired. He brought that chaos and combativeness to the country's top office. Now we have the man he derisively called Sleepy Joe Biden. Let us bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. So glad you're here, David. Let's talk about this landscape. On day one, Fox News opinion host came out swinging against new President Biden. Here's Sean Hannity.
In his first address to the nation, Joe predictably meandered his way through what is a truly unremarkable, totally forgettable, even pre-rehearsed set of remarks. Let's be honest. The rest of the media mob, they were just flat out lying to the American people as per usual. This was not in any way, shape, manner, or form a memorable speech.
The rest of the media mob, that included in Fox's news division, Fox's Chris Wallace, because he called Biden's inaugural address the best he'd ever heard. David, we know there's a divide within Fox, but it seems more pronounced since Trump ditched Fox News for other networks, One America and other, partisan outlets, because Fox News acknowledged that Biden won. So what's going on at Fox?
Well, I think it's important to note that Trump didn't really ditch Fox. What Trump did was get angry at those at Fox who would sometimes admit facts against his interest or report the news. And there are some journalists at Fox who work diligently to do just that. It's just not the point of Fox. Trump doubled down on the sort of sycophantic far-right media and on those folks within Fox who comprise a lot of its most important hours, people in primetime, Maria Bartiromo, Lou Dobbs, Fox and Friends, people who would give him time of day. We just heard Sean Hannity described the rest of the media as a mob. Let's think about the word mob and what context mm-hmm. we've heard that in the past couple of weeks. We heard about him saying that the rest of the media is lying to you. Let's think about the way in which the American people were lied to by the ex-president and some of his most prominent supporters, some of them on Fox News itself. What Fox is desperate to do is to try to hold on to the president's core voters who have been very demoralized by what's happened, which they've said repeatedly, and to keep that as their base. How do they do that? Well, they pivot away from talking about the events of 1-6 or the rifts within the Republican Party about the questions of accountability, and they focus all on, let's look back at Hunter Biden. Let's find ways to attack Joe Biden. Let's find ways to figure out lines to demonize Kamala Harris, the new vice president. There are ways in which they're trying to shift attention and their narrative to try to make themselves in some ways victims of what's played out and to make themselves able to go on the attack against a new administration rather than defending the old one.
I feel we always have to slap that back a little bit. Hunter Biden, who make foolish business decisions. Investigations found he did not do any influence peddling when it came to his father, who was then vice president. But David, you know, more about how the Trump followers are addressed. We're reading about how believers in the ridiculous QAnon conspiracy theory that Trump was here to save America from Democrats who were trafficking and with children are now shocked that that's not true. And then there was the insurrection, as you mentioned, 1-6. How does the hard right media cater to Trump's base as it may be discovering it was lied to?
Well, you've seen them have to back off a little bit about some of this explicit claims about the election in the face of some very strong and probably pretty powerful legal arguments made by lawyers for one of the main voting machine companies, Dominion, that a lot of seemingly completely false claims were made about. And yet the larger claims, utterly baseless, continue to be propagated in places like Newsmax, places like OAN, places like Gateway Pundit, other places online. Fox News itself, you asked about how they've changed. What we know, they say they've done a certain kind of restructuring to meet the moment and the finances and what have you. But they also ushered a number of their sort of more straight ahead news folks out the door, particularly on the digital side, including a fellow named Chris Steirwalt, who is not only the political editor for Fox, but somebody who appeared on the air and somebody who defended Fox's call on election night itself of Arizona for Joe Biden, not for Donald Trump. That was the first outlet to do it. It has been a sore point ever since. There's been reporting that suggests that Rupert Murdoch, the ultimate owner of Fox News, weighed in and said, we don't want to be in the calling Trump's supporters out camp. We want to be finding ways to appeal to them. And you've seen them also strip away an hour of news at 7 o'clock each night that was devoted to news. And instead, now it's for harder opinion.
Yeah, I want to make sure I've asked you. I mean, of course, there's CNN. And here's CNN's late night opinion host, Don Lemon, who marked the end of Trump's presidency after playing a clip from Trump's 2016 inaugural address.
4 years that started with that speech about American carnage. 4 years ending with true American carnage. A riot. A pandemic. Carnage. More than 400,000 Americans dead from coronavirus. And a president whose dereliction of duty let this all happen on his watch.
Look, strong words. And much of CNN's fuel was in criticizing President Trump in the last few months especially. But David, we're reading a column in today's Washington Post. It's from opinion editor Karen Atiyah. It's titled, "The Media Had a Role to Play in the Rise of Trump. It's Time to Hold Ourselves Accountable." She calls out the endless oxygen, she says, given to Trump lies. And you could add, while many newsrooms were debating whether or not to call them lies, she takes on otherism, the idea that you couldn't say something negative about Donald Trump unless you said something negative about Democrats. Does she have a point in the minute we have?
I mean, the crazy thing is this is something that people in jobs like mine have been doing since 2015, 2016, about the election period. I think there's a danger of not examining what we've done right and what we've done wrong in the Trump years. There's a danger of overcompensating and trying to prove that we're tough on Biden. And at the same time, there's also a danger of saying that Trump has so distorted and warped our norms that you're not going to hold Biden accountable for even the more moderate transgressions. I think that Biden has to be held accountable. He has to be pushed to be transparent. And, you know, the way in which the press stands up for its values is not to be partisan, but it's to be vigorous in its pursuit of truth, facts for the public it serves, no matter who's in power.
Well, we'll have discussion another time, I think, about, you know, whether newsrooms are soul-searching after the last 4 years. I'd love to have more time with you on that. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you so much.
You bet.
Over the last 4 years, we've heard the term fake news a lot. But it's not a new concept. The phrase fake news began circulating in the late 19th century when it was used to drum up increased newspaper circulation. And before news footage on film was widely available, an entirely different type of invented news was very commonplace. Katie Soul of the Bittersweet Life podcast brings us the story of the March of Time news.
Back in the time when we all saw movies in theaters, you didn't see the film without a good dose of this first.
In a world.
Delicious things to eat.
In a world.
The popcorn can't be beat.
But it wasn't always that way. Until the 1950s, you got a good dose of news before you were allowed to escape into a Hollywood fantasy land.
the march of time.
Beginning in 1935, the march of time started replacing silent newsreels in movie theaters, and it was a welcome change. The March of Time was produced by the creators of Time and Life magazine, and they wanted the news to feel alive, like it was happening to the viewer at that moment. And so they recreated the news. They hired actors and wrote scripts that imagined real events. Then they added in voiceovers and real news footage.
With plans drawn for a New England Nazi encampment, he meets unexpected opposition in a community long proud of its tolerance.
Two of my great-great-grandfathers and four of my great-grandfathers fought for liberty. So did the other people of this town. I call upon all of you here to keep the Nazis out.
Just as in filmmaking, scenes of Nazi Germany might be shot in the United States. An actor might play the president in a closed-door meeting. Sometimes actual lawmakers appeared as themselves, reenacting an event they actually lived. These tactics weren't a secret. Henry Luce, head of Time Life Fortune Incorporated, called it fakery in allegiance to the truth. And the audience didn't seem to mind. They were familiar with the show long before it hit the big screen. The March of Time began first as a radio show.
Tonight, Time, the weekly news magazine, raises the curtain again on their reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week from the March of Time.
The radio actors were hired for their ability to impersonate newsmakers. Orson Welles played Sigmund Freud. Agnes Moorehead played Eleanor Roosevelt. And the show imitated FDR so well, the president eventually asked the producers to stop portraying him. His political advisors kept calling to ask him about statements he never actually made. Dramatizing the news isn't acceptable anymore. But in the early 1930s, radio had to invent scenes. The technology to report live from the scene just didn't exist yet, especially in 1931 when the show first premiered. That very first show, they imagined Chicago Mayor Big Bill Thompson smugly celebrating his re-election.
Let's review some of the dramatic events of the week. It's a walk-away, Mayor Thompson.
Congratulations, Bill. Thank you, boy. Thank you. Say, your mayor will go on building Chicago's skyline. It'll be just too bad for the nitwits that get in the way.
The radio show was scripted, but the March of Time did respond to breaking news, throwing out scripts and writing new ones an hour before airtime. And this led to a new kind of actor, one that could perform a script perfectly, having never seen it before. Orson Welles became a master at this, and he considered the show the greatest thrill of his life. Later, his movie, Citizen Kane, featured a parody of the March of Time that many of you remember.
News on the march!
Since the pyramids, Xanadu is the costliest monument a man has built to himself. Here in Xanadu last week, Xanadu's landlord was laid to rest. America's Kublai Khan, Charles Foster Kane.
Today we wouldn't trust dramatizations as a reliable source of information, right? Or would we? The framework of the March of Time is very much alive on modern television. It's just not on a news network. You're more likely to find it on the History Channel.
U.S. Airways Flight 1549 has just left New York's LaGuardia Airport.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Cactus 1549.
You can land runway 1 at Peterborough.
Can't do it. We're going to be in the Hudson.
And perhaps the strangest remnant of the March of Time is the charitable organization The March of Dimes, originally started by Franklin Roosevelt to combat polio. The president called his organization the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, not as catchy as the parody nickname that Eddie Cantor, the radio comedian, came up with. The nickname stuck, and the foundation used it to encourage children to donate a dime of their own money to help. And even though President Roosevelt had an issue with the way The March of Time portrayed him, in a way, that show gave him his own coin. He became so associated with the March of Dimes, his picture is now on all of the dimes in your pocket. For Here and Now, I'm Katie Sewell.
And Robin, what would it be like if we actually delivered the news with that voice?
Acting, acting, go for it.
Acting Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.